That was a nice shot. Welcome. You're taking Dead Aim with Charlie Nance. Taking Dead Aim is sponsored by RBC Wealth Management. Now, here's the host of Taking Dead Aim, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Hey, just a couple of things in the game to talk about this week. Both of them huge, and both of them can be somewhat traced back to the same lady. Lexi Thompson teamed with Tony Finau last weekend at the QBE shootout. For years and years, it was the Shark Shootout, still hosted by Greg Norman, by the way. They finished in a tie for fourth on a golf course that was playing almost 7,400 yards. Oh, did I mention that Lexi was the only lady golfer in the field? You know, I was curious to see how her game would hold up on a course with, well, for lack of a better term, man distances. And it appears playing golf against the men in her family growing up has paid off. She more than held her own. She was downright impressive with her shot making. Hey, speaking of Lexi, do you remember the first major on the LPGA this year? The A&A Inspiration? Do you remember the egregiously unfair penalties assessed to her? If not, let me refresh your memory quickly. On Saturday's third round, a viewer, quote-unquote, and I'll get to those quotes in a minute, noticed that she mismarked her ball on a green. Somehow this word was able to be given to tournament officials. And on Sunday, not only was Lexi assessed a two-stroke penalty for the infraction, but a two-stroke penalty for signing an invalid scorecard. Essentially, she was given a four-stroke penalty on the back nine of a major when she had the lead. Well, there went the lead, but she was still able to tie it up and get into a playoff, although she ultimately lost. There's so much about this that is unfair, I don't even know where to start. Well, this week, both the USGA and the RNA announced they will no longer be taking such reporting from non-participants. Good. Also, that two-stroke penalty for signing an incorrect scorecard after the fact, well, that's gone as well. Good. Now, how about a little transparency? I said this then, and I will say it now. There has never been a viewer on the couch in Omaha who can get a PGA tournament on the phone. Period. This is one of the most widely accepted and most ridiculous canards in history. I'll tell you what, why don't you try to get the front desk of your local TV station on the phone at noon on Sunday? Good luck. There's no receptionist on duty. Now, if you can't get a local TV station on the phone, how easy do you think it is to get a network broadcast truck on the horn on Sunday? These viewers that call in, they're ex-players and or members of the broadcast community that have a producer or a cameraman's contact info in their phone. Regular people do not have and have never had that kind of access. Okay, I'm off that soapbox. I'm just glad golf did the right thing here. This week, we revisit a couple of conversations from earlier this summer. J.P. Hebert is the nephew of Lionel and son of Jay Hebert, two brothers from Louisiana who won the PGA Championship 3 years apart. This year was the 60th anniversary of Lionel's title and the 57th for Jay. J.P. and I grew up together, and we had the chance to catch up prior to this year's PGA Championship at Quail Hollow. But we begin today with a participant in the 1999 Senior Open, my friend and Carolina senior golfing icon, Captain Bob Desjardins. Now, were you a golfer growing up, or did you take it up later on as an adult?
No, my dad started me when I was probably seven, but I was playing everything at that point, you know, baseball and basketball and football, and then I did play during the summer. I did play in some junior events around town, and I guess when we got to high school, we kind of laid off golf because I was really concentrating on other sports at that point. And then once we got back into college, we started playing again and just started playing a lot more after that.
Now, I know you're an uber competitive guy. How long was it after you took up the game again in college that you started to get down, you know, to around scratch and to the competitive levels that you've been at for as long as I've known you?
That was after I got out of the Navy. And I got hired by the airlines in 78. And when you get working with the airlines, the first thing you do, you're on reserve. And so they may call you, they may not call you. And so when they weren't calling me, There were a couple of facilities around our house that I was able to practice at. And so I got in a lot of practice at that point, and then that's when the handicap started marching toward zero. And at that point, we really started to take it seriously as far as being an amateur.
Now, was this when you were living in San Diego, or where were you then?
Yeah, we were in San Diego at this point.
Bob Desjardins, a former participant in the United States Senior Open, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Now, at this time, you've told me stories before. When did you meet Billy Casper, and you played a couple of rounds of golf with him?
Well, I met Billy at San Diego Country Club. I joined there in the mid-'80s, and he was at San Diego Country Club for a very, very long time, and he was playing there. I played one day with a real good friend of his, and he said, "How would you like to play with Billy sometime?" And I said, "Well, I'd love to." So he set it up, and the next week, you know, it was my first opportunity to play with Billy Casper, so that was really cool.
Were you intimidated at all, or were you pretty confident in what you were doing at that point, or was it weird? What was that feeling like?
Well, it was, I was so psyched up to play that first round of golf with him that I showed up early, and I warmed up, and I putted, and I chipped, and I did everything. I was so ready to go. And while I'm doing all of this, Billy's in the clubhouse eating lunch.
So he's not nearly as psyched up to play you as you are to play him.
Can you believe that? So we get to the first tee, and he says, "Bob," he says, how about you leading us off?" And I said, "Okay, fine." So I got up there, and I hit one as good as I can hit one, right down the middle. And he gets up there, and he does a couple of stretches. He has not hit a ball yet. And kind of stretches his back a little bit, okay, and then tees it up and hits it 10 yards by me.
Should have had lunch.
Yeah, should have had lunch. That's not the best part. The best part is, after I hit one on the green, he hits 9-iron in the hole.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. So the very first hole I play with Billy Casper, he makes eagle.
So at this point, you're out. I'm trying to gauge your psyche starting to think towards, you know, what can I qualify for? You're out of the range really to do the USAM. Did you ever have thoughts of trying to qualify for the mid-AM, or did you try?
I never did try that, simply because I couldn't dedicate enough time to go to a tournament like that because I was a working stiff. And so it really didn't come into play. All of my golf was basically in the San Diego area, maybe occasionally up in L.A.
Bob Desjardins is our guest taking Dead Aim, a former participant in the United States Senior Open. You played in the 99 Senior Open at Des Moines Golf and Country Club. And one of the things I found interesting in thinking about this is, unlike the regular U.S. Open, distance and size, of course, doesn't really matter. So the USGA can take the Senior Open just about anywhere. That being said, couldn't have been that exciting to go to Des Moines, Bob.
Well, I'll tell you what. I had a friend that had played in the Senior Open the year before when it was in L.A. at Riviera. And the people in L.A. were just kind of so-so with this tournament because there's so many things to do in L.A.
Right.
Well, we got to Des Moines, and they had never seen anything like this. And they came out, and they were the best fans. They were just autograph seekers like crazy. It couldn't have been a better venue to have gone to play a big tournament like this, because the people were wonderful.
Yeah, you know, you're right. The circus doesn't come to town very often, so when it does, everybody wants to see it and reach out and touch it. Before we hit on the Open itself, I want to talk about qualifying for the United States Senior Open. So how far in advance did you try to qualify before, or was 1999 the first year you tried?
No, that was the first year I tried. It was the first year I was eligible.
So you turn 50 and you try for the Senior Open. this is a process that's much, I don't want to say easier because that diminishes it, and I don't mean it to, but the process of qualifying for the U.S. Open starts with 9,000 people and local qualifying over 36 holes, and then you have sectional qualifying over 36 holes, and at the end of the day, you know, you've got 70 spots from 9,000 people. It's just incredibly daunting. Qualifying for the Senior Open is a lot different and a lot, let's just say, a lot more basic, right?
Well, it sure is, compared to the U.S. Open. You're talking about one qualifying site. So you go, and if you qualify that day, you're in. There were 100 guys trying to qualify at my site, and then we qualified three people.
Wow. So three spots for 100?
Yeah.
Is it a 36-hole qualifier or just 18?
Oh, no. This is a senior qualifying. Come on. We can only play 18.
Now, did you know where you stood? Was there live scoring with you as you went around?
No, absolutely not. The only time I was toward the end of the groupings, and I thought the number was going to be somewhere like 4 under par. And I came to the 17th hole, and I was 3 under par, and our 17th hole was that day was a par 5, and so I went for it in 2 and left it off to the right of the green and messed the chip up. And to make a long story short, I bogeyed this par 5, so now I'm back to 2 under, and I go to the 18th hole, hit it in the fairway, hit it on the green, and there's a buddy of mine up on the patio, and I walked up before I putted, and I said, what kind of scores are in? He says there's a 69, which is 300, and then a bunch of 72s. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, how do you stand? And I said, well, I'm 2 under right now. He says, well, just 2 putt, and I think you're looking pretty good. So I had about 20 feet or so, and I got up there, and I knocked the putt up, and it wasn't a bad putt. It was probably a foot and a half that I had left, and I marked it, and I let the other guys finish. And I put the ball back down, and Chuck, to this day, I have no idea how the ball went in the hole because my hands were shaking so hard. The putter was just wobbling like crazy, and somehow I hit it on the right jerk and got it in the hole and qualified.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when it hit you, the enormity of the situation you were in, of what was at stake, or, you know, you probably were better off if you'd have never gone up and said anything to your buddy and just finished out the hole.
Yeah, absolutely. If I would have just not known a thing, I would have gone up there, lagged it up, tapped it in, and, you know, we're done with it. But having known... It certainly got the nerves going.
What would it have been like if you'd have found out where you stood before you teed off on 18? I asked this because I had Scott Harvey on the show a few weeks ago talking about qualifying for the U.S. Open. And on 18, he knew that he had a stroke to play with, and it was a par 4, and he put the driver back in the bag, and he played it as a par 5, and he hit 5 iron, a wedge, and then chipped it up and 2-putted for bogey, and that was it. If you'd have known where you stood, would you have played it differently, or do you think it would have been like that putt, only starting at the tee box?
I probably would have played it the same way, hitting driver and hitting the second shot, because there were still groups behind me that I didn't know how they stood. And as it turned out, there was one guy that shot 1 under, and then there was another guy that was at even par. So I probably would have played it the same, because I still had to play hard.
Bob Desjardins is a former participant in the United States Senior Open. He participated in the one in 1999 at Des Moines Golf and Country Club. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. So let's get to Des Moines Golf and Country Club. Do you arrive the weekend before, or when do you get there?
I got there Sunday afternoon, the week before, and just checked in. And then Monday was my first practice round.
What was it like the first time you walk out on the driving range at a United States, a USGA Open, so the Senior Open, and someone walks out with a cardboard placard and sticks it, you know, on your slot. There is Robert Desjardins, and it hits you. Oh my God, I'm actually here and I'm actually doing this.
Well, my son and I were walking out to the driving range, and before I could get to the driving range, these people started mobbing me, and I had to sign autographs. And this was the kind of attitude that they had in Des Moines. They were going crazy. And this is Monday. And so I told my son, I said, go find a spot on the range. I'll meet you there as soon as I can. And it was at least 20 minutes before I could finish with all the signing just to get to the driving range.
Did any of the legitimate celebrities that were, you know, professional golfers see you signing these things and just laugh?
No, because everybody was signing. I mean, these people, if you had a golf bag, you were going to sign autographs. It was crazy. The practice rounds, you signed between every green to the next tee. And then when we finished the practice rounds, it was 40 minutes before I could get to the clubhouse.
Did you take the opportunity to play a practice round with one of these guys that you've admired your whole life? Or who did you play with?
I did. On Wednesday, I had an opportunity to play with Graham Marsh.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, who had played and had won the Senior Open a couple of years before. And that was a lot of fun. It was just Graham and I. And we went out and played 18 holes. And what a gentleman. We had a real special day that day.
Your name gets announced on the first tee on Thursday. Which was more of a nerve-wracking moment, making the putt to actually qualify or hitting that first tee shot at the United States Senior Open?
You know, that tee shot wasn't as bad as the tee shot that I hit on Monday of the practice round.
Really?
Because you have to understand, it's Monday, the practice round, there's nobody around. There had to be 2,000 people around the first tee, and they were announcing you to the first tee on Monday.
Oh, the practice rounds?
The practice round.
Wow.
Now, my worst fear comes right in front of me. They announce the guy that I'm going to play with, and he gets up there, and he has my nightmare. My nightmare is dribbling the ball off the tee.
Oh.
And he does it. And
that's all that's in your head.
Oh, and then he announces me, and then I get up there, and I'm hitting a 3-wood because it's a short little dogleg right par 4, and I go through my routine. I tee the ball up. I go through my routine, get over the ball. I hit the ball. I look up, and I don't see a thing. But it felt pretty good.
Right.
So I went back to my son, and I said, where'd it go? He said, hey, Dad, it was really good, right down the middle. He said, how did you get the ball to stay on the tee? Your hands were shaking.
I can imagine. So at the end of two rounds, you don't make the cut. How far are you off the number?
I believe, and don't hold me to this, but I believe the number was, I want to say 6 over, something like 6 or 7 over.
Yeah.
And I was not close. I shot 80, 81, I believe.
Were you really disappointed in your play, or did it not really matter to you? You were like, man, I got here.
I was disappointed to some degree because normally my strength is driving the ball in the fairway. And I missed so many fairways in 2 days. And I just, that's where I was losing strokes. And so I was disappointed in that. And I was hitting a lot of good iron shots, but the iron shots, you're in the fairway and you're away from the people. On the tee, everybody's right around you. And it's just not being used to the environment of having that many people that close to you trying to hit golf shots.
Pop quiz. Do you know who finished runner-up that year?
Oh, boy.
I could probably sit here all day and you'd never get this.
I know Hal Irwin was in the hunt, but I don't think he finished second. I think he was like top five or something like that.
Ed Dougherty.
Dougherty, that's right, because I talked to him on the range one day, and I mean, the guy's got forearms like, I mean,
Popeye.
Like a lumberjack.
Yeah.
But that's right, he did. He's right there at the end.
Now, do you remember who won?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me that question. I've been thinking about it.
Because you blew it on first runner up.
I know. And I can picture him because I walked right by him when he had the trophy in his hand.
Well, you photobombed his trophy celebration?
No. Now, back in those days, there was no such thing as photobombing.
Dave Eichelberger won the 1999 Senior Open.
That's right. That's exactly right. That was a pretty big upset, actually, because Eichelberger was a pro for a long time, but he's not one of those names that you would think that would be winning a Senior Open.
Bob Desjardins is a participant in the 1999 United States Senior Open. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. The story famously is that your two-day total was actually lower than the late, great Arnold Palmer's. Is that correct?
That is correct, but it has a little bit of an asterisk by it.
Okay.
On his 36th hole, he putted up to about 3 feet, and then he sort of straddled the line and hit it with the end of his putter into the hole. And the USGA, in their infinite wisdom, decided to throw two shots on him, and that's the reason I beat him.
All right. Get you out of here on this, and this is a big, important question.
Oh, God.
What means more to you in your life right now, the fact that you can always say that you beat Arnold Palmer, or would it mean more to you if you actually were able to win a beer off of me this weekend?
Oh, no. There's no question about this. I want that beer, and I want that.
He's my only friend that can say that at some point in a tournament he beat Arnold Palmer. That's Captain Bob Desjardins, participant in the 1999 Senior Open and Carolina Senior golfing legend. And when we return, it's the 60th anniversary of his uncle Lionel's PGA Championship, the 57th anniversary of his dad Jay's PGA Championship, assistant men's golf coach for the University of Texas, and my friend J.P. Hebert takes Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. We are taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. J.P. Jean-Paul Hebert is the assistant head men's golf coach at the University of Texas, a phenomenally successful program. He was a golfer at Texas, a really great amateur in his own right. He's also the nephew of Lionel Hebert and son of Jay Hebert, two brothers from Louisiana who won the PGA Championship 3 years apart. This year was the 60th anniversary of his uncle's title, the 57th of his dad's. JP and I grew up together, and we had the chance to catch up earlier this summer, just prior to the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow. JP, we've sort of touched on this before, but growing up, and I've talked to a lot of guys who we grew up in and around you and your family, we all knew that you and Jason's dad had played golf. But I don't remember being aware of his or your uncle's major place in the game. At what point do you remember thinking or finding out, you know, Dad may be a little more important than I think?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because growing up, your dad is always just your dad.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what we thought. That's JP and Jason's goofy dad over there.
It's your dad. And then we'd go to, you know, some cool golf course. You know, we'd go to some tournament or go to the Masters or go something like that, and people were really nice to him and they were happy to see him. And then you start thinking, wow, maybe there's something to this. But I even forget it to this day that, you know, what those guys accomplished. And I think what's really amazing is when I think about where they began, and they just grew up caddying at a 9-hole municipal golf course in Lafayette, Louisiana. They grew up caddying at this place. And then the two of these guys grow up to eventually become PGA champions on two courses in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy. And today, that course in Lafayette, Louisiana, is still there. It's now 18 holes. It's called J and Lionel Hebert Municipal.
No kidding.
Yeah.
When did they rename that, JP?
About 20 years ago.
That is really, really cool. So your uncle got to see that.
Yes.
Fantastic.
That's right.
John Paul Hebert is our guest taking Dead Aim. There's nearly 5 years difference between your dad, Jay, and your uncle, Lionel. Do you remember them being close?
They were close. They raised families in different cities.
Yeah, I mean, Lionel was a Louisiana man forever, and I know, of course, your family's a Houston base.
Right. But they were always close. They kind of stayed in touch with their good old tour friends, and then they started pairing up together to play in the Legends in Austin, which was kind of like a precursor to the senior tour, now the Champions Tour. So they were just too connected in golf, and they were both two of the most passionate people about life, but really about golf that I ever knew.
How much trash got talked between the two of them that you remember?
Oh, occasionally, you know, I think they only talked trash, and Jackie Burke and the same deal, and the Harmon family. They only kind of talked some trash when they needed to. It's like they kept a little bit in their back pocket just in case they needed it. But and I think I do the same thing, actually. But they, you know, they were competitive, but they helped each other a lot back then. I think that was just part of the way they grew up. They didn't grow up with a whole lot. They helped people.
Well, and really, that was the way of the tour back then. You know, it wasn't like it is now. You know, everybody, you know, partnered up in hotel rooms and buddied up in cars and shared expenses, and so there was much more of a brotherly camaraderie. And I mean, especially brotherly in your uncle and father's case. But you know, it was a different time and a different way that those guys all interacted and felt about one another.
It was just different all around, and they started. Before you could even play golf full time, even make a living, they all had their club pro jobs. Most of them did, or some maybe had some other kind of job, and then they played the winter circuit, which was about a 3-month circuit that started in California and kind of went across into New Orleans and maybe stopped right there. And so they weren't playing for that much money. They loved it. They all wanted to try to get better. They wanted to win, but they still had that helpful kind of a giving spirit about it all.
JP Hebert, son of Jay, nephew of Lionel Hebert, is our guest taking Dead Aim. We'll get to more of your dad in just a second, but this year is, gosh, JP, it's the 60th anniversary of Lionel Hebert's PGA win at Miami Valley Golf Club in Dayton, Ohio, a Donald Ross course still in existence, all 6,400 yards of it. And there's a couple of interesting things about 1957. This was the last year that the PGA Championship was contested in match play. And unlike some previous years, there wasn't even a medal play qualifier. There used to be a 36-hole medal play qualifier to get down to the match play. Oh, no. 128 players, 9 rounds of match play over 4 days. So a possibility of 162 holes. I don't know how else to say that. That would suck. Do you remember any discussions of how much they did or did not like a major championship being contested like this? I mean, can't you remember when the WGC match play was still single elimination and people lost their minds?
Match play is so tough. It's a different animal. But, yeah, 128 guys just went straight in. And then in the semis and the finals, they played 36 hole matches, and they played some consolation matches in there too. But
that was the other thing that I saw. There were it was like, God, the golf never ended.
Right. What a long, long week. I think the tournament initially started. It would end on like Tuesday or Wednesday, And then back in like the mid 50s, they started ending it on the weekend. But I mean, but it was just a marathon of a week.
I can't imagine being a spectator trying to keep track of all of that. I mean, we're used to 64-person brackets, you know, for the World Golf Championship match play. Not 128. That's insane.
Incredible, incredible.
Now, the quarterfinals turned out to be really important. But before we get to that, both your dad and your uncle made the quarters. Did they have any close calls in the first couple of rounds?
I don't know. I actually, you know, I regret not asking a lot more questions as a kid, but I don't know much about the early rounds. I know that they were close to playing each other.
Well, that's what we're going to get to. So the quarterfinals, your Uncle Lionel is playing Claude Harmon, who I assume was a very close friend. The 1953 PGA champ, his name was Walter Bergamo, and he becomes my new favorite asterisk in golf history because he beat your pop 2-1, and therefore it prevented a brother-on-brother semifinal. Can you imagine in today's age of media coverage how much traction that would have gotten?
I know. Incredible. And the little brother, yeah, you know, I know. I'm sure I know where you're going with this, but yeah, the thought of that, they talked about it. I'm guessing, looking back, they're glad they didn't have to do that. But they each ended up having their moment. So
this has to have been the subject of much needling over the years with the little brother. You know, saying, "Hey, man, I had, not only did I win, but I had to beat the guy that beat you." I mean, what are we talking about here? That had to come up all the time. It would if I was the little brother, it would come up all the time.
Yeah, not only that, Bergamo had to play, you know, a bear two matches in a row, you know. So tough to beat two of them, but
absolutely.
You know, Lionel, being the younger brother, 5 years younger, he was like 32 years old, and back then you had to kind of serve your time. In order to even play in the PGA Championship, you had to be a member of the PGA of America, which required 5 years of being a member. So, this was his first full time. If this was his first season full time as a player, and he wins, and back then a major got you a lifetime exemption.
Oh wow!
So here's the little brother. Wins the PGA, now he's got a lifetime exemption on the PGA Tour.
Now, did they grandfather that in, so even if the rules changed later on, they held up his lifetime exemption?
They did.
Cool!
And there's a few guys still alive today that could, you know, if they really wanted to. I think they, but I think, and there were a few guys that kind of fought it for a while, and there was a time when a commissioner... And there was a new commissioner that was going to take away those rights, and they fought to keep it.
Well, that's the only right thing to do. I remember we'll get to some more stuff at Akron here in a minute, but I remember when that was the World Series of Golf and before it became a WGC event, and the World Series of Golf carried with it a 10-year exemption on the PGA Tour. And then when they changed those rules, they grandfathered Jose Maria Olazabal, I think, was the last person to win it as the World Series of Golf, and they grandfathered his 10-year exemption in there. So yeah. The tour kind of has a history of living up to their word. I was just wondering if they did that.
They did.
He's the assistant head men's golf coach at the University of Texas, J.P. Hebert, Jean-Paul, son of Jay, nephew of Lionel. More of our conversation with him as he takes dead aim at some pretty heady stuff. His dad's PGA Championship at Akron, presented by RBC Wealth Management. We're taking dead aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management, and now more of our conversation from this past summer with J.P. Hebert, assistant head men's golf coach at the University of Texas, nephew of the 1957 PGA champion Lionel Hebert, and son of the 1960 PGA championship Jay Hebert, and that's where we pick things up. JP, in their careers, did they have many occasions where both of them were in the hunt like this?
They did. you know, for a while, they both were playing really well at the same time. They didn't have really long, strong careers, but they both kind of had, you know, a little small window of time, mid-50s to kind of early 60s, where they were really playing well. And so they traveled a lot. They never got to a place where they were in a playoff against each other. But, you know, they had a lot of good finishes between the two of them.
J.P. Hebert, son of Jay and nephew of Lionel, is our guest taking dead aim. All right, in the finals, your uncle beats Dal Finsterwald. And what's interesting about that is the very next year when it became a stroke play event, Dal Finsterwald won the PGA Championship. Now, something that I could not find, and I don't know if you knew of a story, the November meetings in 57, after the championship, the determination was made to move to medal play. Did something happen at the 57 championship to really prompt this, or was this just something that had been building for a while and everybody said, okay, enough's enough?
I don't really know, but supposedly the players during 1957 didn't know that that was going to be the last year as match play. So I don't think anybody knew, but they might have started to get a sense that, you know, maybe a lot of the best players aren't around, kind of like the way we view it nowadays.
Right.
But I think that if they would have maintained that, if the PGA Championship would have maintained that match play, maybe it would have that identity about itself. You know, who knows? But stroke play, as we know, stroke play, 72-hole stroke play, really determines, I think, the best golf gets rewarded throughout the course of the tournament. And I think you get a better champion that way.
Now, I need to point out that JP is an assistant head coach at the University of Texas. And so this is a source of great consternation with college coaches that the finals of the NCAA tournament are contested in team match play. From the tone of your voice, I take it you wish it was all stroke play?
Well, I'll say this. I will say that stroke play is going to reward the better players, the better teams. And in 9 years now of the NCAA Men's Championship going to the match play format, the new format, the number one seed has never won the match play portion. So now the match play, people love it. It's great for television. It's great for ratings. It's great for the college game. I think that it has brought college golf, I think it's really turned up the heat on college golf. And people are following it now more than ever. So to say that I don't like it, I'm not going to say I don't like it. But is it going to really reward the best teams and the best players? Probably not.
This is the part where I point out that my Baylor Bears made it to the finals and his Texas Longhorns didn't. But that's a whole different story for another time. J.P. Hebert is our guest taking dead aim. Let's talk a little bit about your dad's win. 1960 PGA win was at Firestone. Judging by his winning score at over par, it was as big a bear then as it is now. What would he think, though, about how equipment and the ball allows those guys to attack that course like that?
Those guys could even imagine what the equipment would be like, what the ball could be like today. You know, they were playing the best equipment that was available at the time. So in their minds, they were playing some great stuff. And a lot of those guys, you know, they hit the middle of the club face. So they were hitting it
oh, yeah,
pretty pure. The equipment was plenty good enough. But it wasn't so good that the equipment was doing a lot of the work for him.
Yeah.
So they had to be good. They had to have good timing. They had to have good grips, so on and so forth. But my father loved, Jay, we're talking about, he loved Firestone. He loved the fact that it was a ball striker's golf course. It really rewarded great driving, great approaches, and it really put out a lot of great champions.
Your dad had top tens in the Masters and the U.S. Open in 58 and 59, but was this really the best chance he had at a major in his career?
You know, I think it was. I think it was. Majors are always tough to win. Doesn't matter who you are.
Oh, absolutely.
He was playing really well. I think he was a bit of an underachiever in his career. Finished second a lot. He had 31 top three finishes in his career and 7 wins.
Because I was thinking about your dad and Matt Kuchar and that what just happened with Matt at the Open Championship. And I was thinking, this is a guy who's as consistent a performer as you find on the PGA Tour. But sometimes the golf gods give you one, maybe two shots at winning one of these things.
Right.
And I had to feel like, you know, for Matt, that may have been his one.
Right. And maybe. And that's what makes this stuff so great. I mean, that's why we're sitting on the edge of our seats watching these majors, because there's so much at stake. These majors are career-defining weeks. And at the end of the day, that's how you really determine the greats from the really good.
I don't expect your dad ever really made a big deal out of this, but when you look at the leaderboard of the 1960 PGA Championship, it reads like a Hall of Fame roll call, JP. Snead, Palmer, Venturi, Sanders, January, Ford, Marr. They were all right there on the leaderboard. Did he ever take a minute to look back at that and go, you know, for that one week, I got them all?
Oh, well, yeah, of course. He had great respect for a lot of these guys. I mean, the stories I heard. The respect those guys all had for each other as people, as players. He was so honored and so thrilled to have won that tournament. And you know, that was the year, 1960. That was kind of a turning point in the game. That was really the beginning of kind of a golden age of golf.
Oh, yeah, you're coming off the U.S. Open at Cherry Hills.
Yeah, Arnold Palmer had just won the Masters and the U.S. Open.
And dang near won the British Open.
Yeah. So he's a guy that, you know, the game was really in a great place all around. And so my dad, a little bit of an older guy, 37 years old, it was a big deal. It was a big deal. He finished birdie par, and on the number 17, he hit 2-iron, 5-iron to about 8 feet and made it. Said he didn't even hit a good, said he hit a bad putt, but the putt went in. And then on 18, I think he knew exactly what he needed to do. And he hit a drive. He steered a driver out there. So he didn't really get it. But he steered it out there, and he got it in play. And he's playing with Doug Sanders and Don January, who had missed the fairway to either side. And it took a couple minutes to find their ball in the rough. So he didn't. I mean, that's how thick the rough was. That's what we're talking about. He's in the fairway. He's happy to be in the fairway. He took a 3-iron. And hit it to 20 feet. And I loved reading this one time. He had a 20-foot putt, and he knew he needed a 2-putt to win. And he lagged it up there to within a couple inches. And after he lagged it up there, he smiled. So it's kind of like, you know, the question is, does anybody ever smile after they miss a putt?
When you say, I think I can handle this one. I think I got this one. Get you out of here on this. J.P. Hebert, son of Jay and nephew of Lionel, is our guest taking dead aim. We have two brothers, two PGA championships. Who had the bragging rights as the best PGA win in the family?
I don't think they cared. You know, my father ended up becoming a Ryder Cup captain, and which is an event put on by the PGA of America as well. And so I know that that was the greatest honor of his life. But that Wanamaker Trophy came back to Mud Avenue in Lafayette, Louisiana, and they brought it back to their mom, who spoke mostly French, mostly exclusively French at the time, and she talked to that trophy when it came back in 1960, and she told the trophy in French, "I bet you didn't think you'd be back in this house."
What a great story. Now, nowadays, you know, they get the trophy for a year and they make a replica of it. And so they have, you know, their own copy forever. Did your dad or your uncle do that? Is there a replica of the Wanamaker running around?
Yes, there are replicas. And you can see those replicas at Oakbourne Country Club in Lafayette, Louisiana. There's an Hebert showroom there, kind of in a little bay of the dining room. It's called the Hebert Room, and it's got their showcases, trophies, Ryder Cup stuff. It's really pretty incredible. I haven't been there in a while. I need to make a trip back. But, yeah, you can get a replica. If you're a past champion, you can buy a replica at any time that's updated. And it's about 10% smaller than the real Wanamaker Trophy.
I always enjoy catching up with old friends. I grew up with J.P. Hebert, and like I said at the start of the interview, we had no idea who his dad and uncle were. His dad, J. Hebert, 1960 PGA champion, and his uncle, Lionel, 1957 PGA champion. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Also, I hope you enjoyed revisiting our talk with a participant in the 1999 Senior Open, Carolina senior golfing legend and my friend, Captain Bob Desjardins. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've been talking about, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast on Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show has finished airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Weather-wise, hey, kind of unseasonably warm for this late in December. Perfect time to get out and enjoy this game that tortures our souls and has our hearts. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management.